Well, beginning at clock, we'll get started, and when we get it, we're short one for a quorum. When we get that, we'll officially call the meeting to order. I'm going to ask all three presenters today if you can make sure you get through this. We're scheduled a half hour for each. We have people that like to ask questions, so leave some room in between there so we can get through all three of them hopefully today. So welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the tape, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning, and again, thank you for the opportunity to come before all of you today. For the record, my name is Sia Hurt, and I am the Executive Director at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and here with me this morning are two members of our team at the Asian Pacific Council, Anjali Cameron to my left, our Research Director, and Katie Sly to my right, our Legislative and Public Affairs Liaison. In order to provide you with an overview of who we are and the work we do as a legislatively created office housed within the executive branch of state government, these two ladies will also be speaking today. As some of you may already know, the Asian Pacific Council was created in 1985, and at that time, Asian Pacific Minnesotans made up less than 1% of Minnesota's total population. Today, our community comprises almost 5% of the state's population. Our enabling statute, which is Minnesota Statute Section 15.0145, defines Asian Pacific Minnesotans as public members with an ethnic heritage from any of the countries east of and including Afghanistan or the Pacific Islands. Today, our community is estimated at 300,000 strong. We are the fastest growing community in the state and across the nation. We reside within every one of Minnesota's 87 counties. However, more than 80% of us reside within the seven-county metro area. Many of you may be familiar with our largest ancestry groups, such as the Hmong, the Asian Indian, the Chinese, and or the Korean. You may not, however, be as knowledgeable about our Kearney, Chukis, or Bhutanese communities. Our council is governed by a 15-member board as described in Subdivision 2 of our enabling statute. 11 of these 15 members are appointed by the governor, and each member identifies as a member of one of the ancestry groups under our umbrella. The remaining four members are appointed by legislative leadership, two from the House, two from the Senate, two are Democrats, and two are Republicans. The board is directed to work with the executive director to carry out the statutory duties of the council. In addition to myself and these two young ladies here, our staff team consists of policy-oriented and community-driven individuals serving in the following capacities. So again, in addition to the three of us, we have our research assistant, our office manager, and we also have two interns and a fellow from the Humphrey. With support and guidance from our board and the Legislative Coordinating Commission, our small team of staff works diligently within state government and the rest of our state and across the state for the implementation of economic, social, legal, and political equality for Minnesotans of Asian Pacific heritage. The efficacy of our council's dedication to the statutory purpose can be seen in how we organize our work and how we go about doing that work. Our work is organized into three categories: community engagement, legislative, and original research. These three areas of work.
Excuse me, Ms. Hurt.
Yes.
Now we have a quorum, so I'm going to officially call the meeting to order, and you can proceed. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the three areas of work, or our work is organized into three areas of work, and these areas are not mutually inclusive. Community engagement is the tie that binds our legislative and research work together. We go about our work by first deploying a biennial. By deploying a biennial community legislative priority survey. This survey is designed to enlist community input as we form our legislative focus during any biennium. Second, hosting events such as our annual day at the Capitol and our legislative session recap immediately after a legislative session. Third, attending and speaking at community-led events about the differences that make our many communities uniquely who they are and the similarities that make all of us Minnesotans and Americans. And lastly, by designing and carrying out research on our communities that contribute original information to our knowledge of Minnesota's many communities. Mr. Chair, members, no other state has an office like the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. We were created to gather intelligence about the realities of our communities, process this information within the appropriate cultural context of these communities, and then to the extent appropriate, use this information to influence how you and these Minnesotans go about co-creating a state where every Minnesotan has the capacity to rise up to the challenges of their lives and to revel in the opportunities of their time. To this end, our council is the advocate for Minnesotans of Asian Pacific heritage. We are the advisor to you and the governor, and in the act of advocating and advising, we are the builder of bridges between our communities and state government. At various times, we have been more properly funded and utilized more in the policymaking arena. In those times, we have contributed significantly to state government's ability to more equitably, more effectively, and more efficiently accomplish its legislative goals. The task before us is challenging, to say the least. Nonetheless, our council remains committed to assisting state government with finding ways to help our communities thrive, thus growing Minnesota's economic pie. We want to foster cooperation rather than competition. Guided by our strategic plan, which you have a copy in the back of the annual report in front of you, and informed by our ongoing engagement with our many communities and our engagement with you and the governor's office, our council's work is not just bipartisan, it is nonpartisan. At this time, Mr. Chair and members, if it works for you, I will turn it over to Katie Sly, our legislative liaison, to provide some details on our legislative work.
Thank you, Sia.
Introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Katie Sly. I'm the Legislative and Public Affairs Liaison for the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. As Sia has laid out, in Subdivision 6 of our enabling statute, it describes the role of the Council as advisor to the governor and the legislature to improve the economic and social conditions of the communities we serve. This role includes, but is not limited to, the development and passage of legislation to address issues of importance and relevance to our communities. Our legislative work is informed by a number of factors. The Council's legislative agenda, which is included in the back packet folder of the annual report, and also the strategic plan, which Sia has pointed out within the report. This is also guided by research, as well as guidance from communities themselves through ongoing stakeholder engagement. These all form the foundation of our legislative initiatives. In 2019, the Council is leading the efforts on two major pieces of legislation. The first initiative is the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Prevention Program Bill, House File 479, Senate File 608, chief authored by Representative Becker Finn in the House and Senator Ralph in the Senate. Nationally, we know that between 21 and 55% of American women of American Pacific Islander descent have experienced domestic violence and or sexual assault. In response to these alarming facts, the Council has sought to address the disproportionately high rates of violence in our Asian Pacific communities and across Minnesota. The bill requests the creation of a competitive grant fund of $5 million over the biennium to fund community-driven and culturally relevant domestic violence and sexual assault prevention programming statewide. The Council, in partnership with the Minnesota Council of Latino Affairs, is also a leading advocate for the Spoken Language Healthcare Interpreting Registry Bill, chief authored by Senator Wicklund in the Senate. With approximately one-third of Minnesota's Asian and Pacific Islander residents identified as limited English proficient, we know that communication is an ongoing healthcare challenge in the communities we serve and in other communities across Minnesota. The bill seeks to replace the current roster of interpreters with a registry system to ensure that Medicaid recipients have access to competent medical interpreters. During the legislative session and throughout the year, our council actively engages community advocates, community-based organizations, local government entities, and state government to inform the best possible policy solutions on behalf of Asian and Pacific Islander Minnesotans and in service to a happy and healthy Minnesota. Our council-led initiatives do not happen in a vacuum. For the last 6 to 7 years, the council has been working to address gender-based violence issues. This is exemplified by our historical and legislative advocacy on these issues. To give you an example, the Working Group on Violence Against Asian Pacific and Pacific Women and Children, which is a bill passed in 2015, has helped us to better understand the nature, scope, and prevalence of violence in our communities. Anjali, my colleague and research director at the Council, will provide additional information regarding the resulting report from the Working Group's efforts. The Exploited Families Rental Assistance Pilot Program, passed in 2016, built off of our understanding and prevalence of gender-based violence issues to provide immediate support to families with minor children in crisis. This bill set up a program that subsidized rent to up to 30% over a two-year time period. Although these are just some examples of the scope of our legislative history and current work, the council also actively tracks legislation, testifies in committee on legislation affecting our communities, and updates and educates our communities on a regular basis as to relevant legislation and routes to legislative participation. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members. I will now turn it over to Anjali Cameron, who will give an overview of the council's research work. Thank you.
And again, identify yourself with the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, for the record, my name is Anjali Mishra Cameron, and I'm Research Director for the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. So as others have already reviewed, in state statute, our duties include acting in an advisory capacity on behalf of Asian Pacific Minnesotans to the legislative and executive branches of state government. In line with these responsibilities, our council must also perform original research designed to specifically identify solutions to the problems faced by our constituencies. To that end, our agency is currently conducting original research on several newer Asian and Pacific Islander communities. You'll find a preview of this report in the back of your folders. It's a document that looks like this. The Emerging Communities Report focuses on five emerging Asian and Pacific communities in Minnesota, including the Karen and Karani refugees from the ongoing civil war in Burma, or Myanmar as it's known, the Lhotshampa fleeing persecution from Bhutan, Guyanese Indians who were brought to the Caribbean as indentured servants, and the Chukchi's peoples resettling from rising ocean levels and deteriorating economic conditions from Micronesia. This is an ongoing study that features an overview of each group's resettlement history, an analysis of an assessment of their current population and demographics, which is otherwise unavailable to you, and an analysis of trending issues within each community. As the demographic numbers for these communities continue to grow, it's critical that policymakers like yourselves, as well as school districts, hospitals, and even community organizations, have a broad understanding of each community's communal history. I also want to emphasize the critical role of community partners in this endeavor. These partners have invited us into their community through events and celebrations. They provide feedback on culturally specific languages and norms, and they have helped our agency specifically build and maintain trust within these very vulnerable populations. The Emerging Communities Report of Minnesota is due out later this summer, and I look forward to presenting on the results of that study to you all then. But I want to mention that this ongoing research is just part of our larger research catalog that the council has completed over the years. I want to highlight a couple of reports that you may find interesting. The first is the Asian Pacific Students in Minnesota Facts Not Fiction Report. This is a landmark report demonstrating the importance of reporting both race and ethnicity data when reviewing student achievement scores and graduation rates. The secondary analysis of disaggregated Department of Ed data continues to inform our work as an agency as to how to best advocate and address the complexity of student needs arising from varied socioeconomic statuses and refugee experiences. There's also the Early Childhood Education Opportunities for Southeast Asian Children report, which was based on national research suggesting that parents in Hmong, Vietnamese, Lao, Cambodian, and Karen communities were enrolling their children in early childhood at alarmingly low rates. The results of this report highlighted cost barriers, particularly for larger Asian Minnesota families with more young children. And even while median household income gaps for these struggling parents was consistently $20,000 behind Caucasian families, they were also not low enough to qualify for CCAP reimbursements. In addition, Southeast Asian parents reported deeply rooted preferences for their children to learn and retain their native language and culture while in childcare. This is very important because that meant enrolling students in traditional pre-K programs as opposed to relying on family caregivers became difficult for parents who wanted to pass on their family's cultural heritage and values while also balancing their desire for their child's future educational success. As Katie mentioned to you, the report on violence against Asian women and children in Minnesota was a direct result of our agency's legislative efforts. This report was the first of its kind examination of the explicit nature, scope, and prevalence rates of gender-based violence in the Asian and Pacific Islander communities of Minnesota. Our agency worked with the Department of Health to conduct this research through a third-party vendor, and the findings of this work included the unique areas of violence experienced by Asian women, specifically the occurrence of abusive behavior outside of the typical intimate partner relationships to include other family members, such as parents or in-laws, as perpetrators of violence, as well as the detrimental impact of cultural stigmatization and shaming on Asian survivors who choose to seek action to seek help for themselves. Finally, as Sia and Katie have mentioned, every 2 years we conduct a biennial legislative priority survey to gain a better understanding of the issues of greatest importance to Minnesotans of Asian and Pacific Islander ancestry. Last year, we collected 800 unique responses during the survey period. Between June and October of 2018, participants were asked to identify their top three priority issues and expand upon why those issues were of greatest impact to themselves or their community. Based on the findings of this report, the five most frequently identified issues for Asian and Pacific Islander populations in Minnesota were higher education, data disaggregation, access to health care, equity and social justice, and immigration rights. The qualitative text analysis of the written responses for participants highlighted themes of accessibility, affordability, and discrimination across multiple issue areas. The Legislative Priority Survey is just one of the many examples of the work that the Council requires us to have a deep understanding of the communities that we serve and build upon the existing relationships we have with those communities. During the survey collection period, Council staff attended more than 28 community events across multiple ethnic groups and around the state of Minnesota. I'm now going to turn it back to our Executive Director, Sia Herr, to talk about the important nature of the relationships that we have with our communities and close the presentation.
Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you, Anjali and Katie. Mr. Chair, members, actually, with the timing in mind, I will actually just bring our presentation to a close on the note that as Minnesota becomes increasingly diverse, the noble intentions of government are no longer good enough. It is our collective work that will make the difference. Many in our culturally, socially, socioeconomically, and linguistically diverse community recognize and value the role that our council has played in their lives and in the state of Minnesota. As you can see, the quotes on this last slide that Anjali just turned to was taken directly out of our 2018 report, and they're brief statements, but they are significant and meaningful to our council, as they are great indicators of the nature of the relationships we've established with communities over the last decade or so, and especially during the last 6 to 7 years. And so with that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your time this morning. We hope we have helped you to see some value in the work of our council. And with that, we'll be happy to take any questions.
Well, thank you. Questions, members? Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for being here and for your important work. You mentioned one of the research projects you worked on was looking at education statistics and trying to get beneath some of the top-level data to more disaggregated data. Wondering what type of availability of data you have now and if it's sufficient to be able to do the type of research you're looking for.
Whoever wants this answer, yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Long. So the study I alluded to was a one-time data release from the Department of Education for disaggregated student data based on ethnicity. And so that was very enlightening because it demonstrated what has long been known by our Asian and Pacific Islander community, that there are gaps between achievement scores, particularly MCA scores in reading, between our immigrant communities such as our Asian Indian, Korean, and Japanese versus those who came here as refugees. Many of them have parents who had limited formal education, or they themselves did not have a formal education or was interrupted due to refugee crisis. So to answer your question directly, right now there is not disaggregated student data at the K-12 level through the Department of Education, but they are pilot testing a program. In state law, there is a newly enacted All Kids Count Act that requires this pilot testing before it's implemented in the 2019-2020 school year for all school districts to report student data based on ethnicity. And that should help enlighten some of the gaps in education we see, specifically in the Asian community. I also want to mention that other than that, we are only able to see this type of disaggregated data based on census information, which does not enlighten us until age 25, when we can see educational attainment differences. And so that's pretty detrimental in the life of a student if you don't know how much they have achieved in terms of education until age 25. So.
Thank you. Any further questions? If not, thank you for your presentation, and thank you for being concise and getting in with under the time. While we're waiting, switching people here, Representative Elkins, have you read the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I have, and am prepared to move their approval.
Representative Elkins moved that the minutes of January 31st, 2019 be approved. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you. And welcome to the committee, and whenever you're ready, please identify yourself with the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Justin Terrell. I'm the Executive Director of the African Heritage Council, and I'm just going to present my our work with you. I'm excited to be here with everyone and to have this conversation. So the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage was originally created in 1980. We went through a redesign, as all the ethnic councils did, in 2014, 2015, where we were previously known as the Council for Black Minnesotans, and now we're the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage. Our charge is the same. We all share the same statute, so I won't go over all those details, but we advise the legislature and the governor on issues that impact our community. Once again, the structure of the council. So we have 11 community members appointed by the governor. Currently, we have six current members. So we have some vacancies there that we're working with the governor's office on filling. In addition, we have four legislative members, two from the House, two from the Senate, from the majority and minority parties. And then four paid staff, the executive director, office manager, outreach coordinator, and legislative coordinator. There's also in statute a provision for commissioner seat that's optional that that we're looking into filling. That's interesting to mention. I'll briefly go over our budget. We have an $806,000 biennium budget. We put in a request this year for a $249,000 increase, which would cover additional space. The council currently, we don't occupy our full suite, so there's a couple empty offices we'd like to occupy with additional staff and interns. And then we also are looking to change our 0.5 legislative coordinator to a 1 and hire a researcher so we can begin doing the facilitating the projects that some of the projects you heard that the Asian Council is working on. So the work of the council, we advise the governor and legislature. We do that primarily through statewide outreach, and we advance a policy agenda. So in 2018, we supported the restoration of voting rights, which was, there was a hearing that we were able to help secure, and had a a really healthy debate. The African-American Family Preservation Act is a bill that we also worked on last year in addressing the disparities in child protection with African-American families. And then the Teachers of Color, Increase Teachers of Color Act, is something that is a policy that the Latino Council is leading on. And obviously we believe that if we have more teachers of color and American Indian teachers, that we would, that that's better for everyone. So, and then we also worked with the SIA and the Asian Heritage and the Asian Council on the domestic violence and sexual assault bill. And then the governor, we worked really close with the Governor Dayton's administration, who took our advice. We sent 9 pieces of advice to the governor last year, and he took action on 2 of them. And we are excited to work closely with his administration. This year, our priority bills are restoration of voting rights. We continue to advocate for that. We're talking about a bill that would re-enfranchise 20,000 African Americans in the state of Minnesota and give them the right to vote. All of you are veteran door knockers, and I'm sure you've had the conversation with your constituents about who is eligible to vote based on felony status and whatnot. And there's a lot of misinformation out there, and we just believe that Minnesota should adopt the North Dakota rule as far as when you step out of prison, you are an eligible voter, even if you're still on probation. In Minnesota, we have kind of long probation periods, up to like 20 years. And so we want people to fully participate in society, and this would have a really big impact in our community, but on the state as a whole. The African-American Family Preservation Act is, we have a press conference on Monday, so there'll be a big launch for that bill next week. And then black immigration is actually a federal issue. We're working on deferred enforcement and deportation and temporary protected status. These are 2 policies that have been set to expire on March 31st, and if they do, this will have a damaging impact on, well, Representative Nelson, this would impact your district pretty significantly. We had a meeting in Brooklyn Park a few weeks ago with over 100 community members came out, and we talked, this is one of the, we talked about all 3 of these issues, but this issue was the one that struck home most for the folks in that community. And we're talking about thousands of people who would be looking at losing their status, losing potentially the right to work, being at risk of potentially being deported, folks who have been here for 30 years and are very much part of the fabric of Minnesota. Additional areas of focus, our council identified housing, workforce and economic development, healthcare, education, transportation, and criminal justice reforms as top areas that we should be focusing on as a council, monitoring bills and in educating the community and working with you all to advance policies that support our community in those areas as well. So I just want to go over our policy criteria real quick. There's a lot of ways to pick policy, and I've been in this role for a little bit over a year now, and so we had to develop some structures on how do we prioritize what we're going to work on. And so the first priority is that it must be led by people of African heritage. So rather than us, since we don't have a researcher, we don't have the ability to come up with a whole lot of great ideas in our office. So we're working with folks in the community, our constituents, who are leading policy efforts in areas that we support. Must have a statewide impact. So, even in a budget year, we're not doing a whole lot of advocating for folks to get direct appropriations and whatnot, but mostly focusing on statewide policy. Even though we support our constituents who lead organizations who are looking for resources from the state. And then it must have people of African heritage actively connected to the policy and the effort. So in the case of the African-American Family Preservation Act, I get calls on a regular basis from families who are going through child protection and are fighting to get their kids back. Like, these are real people, these attached to this issue, and we want to make sure that we're here advocating for them. And that's the same across the board with all of our policies. We just want to make sure that it's not just a paper coalition, but that there are real folks behind it so that they get to know you all and you all get to know them, and as they're in your, as and you can see the impact in your own districts. And then the council members approve the agenda. So our outreach efforts last year, you know, I'll just say that our agency has had various different levels of functionality. And so when I started this this position, I realized the first thing we had to do was travel the state and meet with folks and, you know, rebuild relationships and build new relationships. And so we spent last year traveling the state, primarily focusing on the Twin Cities, St. Cloud, Duluth, and Rochester. We sponsored over 50 and co-hosted over 50-plus events around the state, mobilized over 300 constituents to come to the Capitol. That's not the total number, but it was definitely the folks who showed up at our invitation. And then we built a statewide network that started with about 500 folks, and now we're over 2,000 face-to-face conversations primarily, where we're able to expand our network, and we are doing things with that network. So this year, our priority is to develop leadership groups in the Twin Cities, St. Cloud, Duluth, and Rochester, and Brooklyn Park, so that we don't just have a list of names there, but that we actually have a table of African Heritage constituents who are part of that community, who can advise us on what's going on locally, and join us at the Capitol to meet with their legislators. An example of this is in Duluth on Election Day, they wanted to get free buses. And so the council worked with folks on the ground there to support. We sent a letter to the Duluth Transit Authority to have free buses on Election Day, which helped a lot of folks get to the polls. Sponsor and co-host events led by org. So this is, we're also working with folks to host events at the Capitol. So this Friday, for example, we've worked with a local group in North Minneapolis from Henry High School to host the 100 Black Men Strong event. So there will be 300 Henry High School students in the Rotunda on Friday. They wanted to come on Friday because they heard it was a little bit slower around here and the students could have a little bit more space, I guess we'll put it that way. And we're really excited to support them and other groups to come to the Capitol and have space to learn about democracy. We have a survey that we launched this year, and in the fall we're doing an annual meeting. So, obviously, and our goal this year is to mobilize 500 constituents to the Capitol. So I'm going to kind of move quickly through this next spot, this next phase of the report, but I want to extend you all an invitation to our Day on the Hill. So February 26th, we'll rally in the Rotunda. We're working with the National Panhellenic Council, which is the Black Greeks Association, and we'll be inviting folks from St. Cloud, Duluth, and Rochester to come down for a lunch, which all of you are also invited to attend. I know some of you have committee at that time. But we'll be in the Rotunda from 2 to 4. A.G. Ellison is going to speak as our keynote. And we have Ashley DeBose is going to perform the Black National Anthem. Tish Jones will be doing some spoken word. So it'll be a great way for you to get to know our community if you would like to stop by. So now I'll just cover some quick stats and statistics about our community. So we're about 425,000 strong. I believe each one of the ethnic councils will tell you that we're the fastest growing community in the state. That's kind of our inside joke. And if you notice the map, there's a lot of red in the Twin Cities area, but there's also a lot of dots in greater Minnesota that are popping up. And so this is, you know, Somali members in Faribault. This is the mosque on Main Street in Wilmer. This is Somali farmers and Sudanese workers in Austin. Our state is becoming more diverse, and as people move, as these communities grow browner, if you will, it raises new issues, and the council is doing our best to stay in relationship with those communities, those community members, so we can help facilitate some of those conversations that might be popping up in greater Minnesota. But if we're being honest, 80% of our population lives in the 7-county metro area. 44% live in Hennepin, 36% live in Minneapolis and St. Paul. So now I'm going to go into a couple of slides that are primarily focused on economics. if you'll notice, we don't have like an economic agenda item for policy because, once again, we have a problem that's led by black folks. But there are plenty of things that, are out there that we're monitoring, issues that we'd like to, that we would like to support. But if you notice, this first slide is median household income. I'm sure this is information you've all seen before. Some of you have because I've presented in other committees. But the trend is up when it comes to household income, which is a good thing for Minnesota. It tells you how strong the Minnesota economy is. At the same time, the disparities are still dramatic. So the highest chart here, the highest income that's represented here is Asian Minnesotans at $74,000. And then American Indians come in at $36,000 and African Americans come in at $38,000. So there, that is quite a dramatic gap. Percentage in poverty, once again, you notice the trend is down over the past few years, which once again is a good thing and speaks to the strength of the Minnesota economy. But once again, if you talk about the poverty rate in Minnesota, you're talking about 10% for all Minnesotans, and for African Americans it's 28%. Unemployment, once again, the trend is down, and for all Minnesotans, 3.7%. For African Americans, we're looking at 8%. So we're still at double. And then these last two slides, I just want to point out. So this is all workers in the state of Minnesota. The blue line is 2011. The green line is 2017. The two columns on the left are full time year round. The first column is lower than 35,000. The second column is higher than 35,000. On the right, these two columns are part-time work in the state of Minnesota. And so I just want to illustrate this for you. So if you look here on the far left, on the far right column, I think I'm doing this right. No, this column over here. You see that, you know, that there's a lot of Minnesotans working part-time work for over $35,000 a year. And then if you look at black workers, that column just shoots up. This is part of the issue that we want to talk about at the council, is that this is your working poor. These are folks working a lot of part-time jobs to make ends meet. And so this is an area of focus that the council will be looking at. And I encourage all of you to look at it as well. This is your gig economy, if you will. And we have to ask the question, like, how hard are Minnesotans working to break even? It also speaks to that trend, that downward trend in unemployment. So we have to really, like, think about how we're looking at the data. So final thoughts that I'll leave you with. This is a little political, Ed, that we've heard in the community a lot. It's just that the way things are, it's not an accident. None of you write laws by accident. Minnesota is constantly ranked in the top five worst states for people of African heritage to live. This is not news to you. We talk about this every year. And we didn't get there by accident. The other thing is that we're not going to get out of it by accident. So, you know, I invite you all, let's work together. Let's take big bites of this apple to try to find real solutions. We ask you to support our policy agenda, to work with the council to develop a long-term plan. And then the last thing I'll just say is that just that we are in an imagination struggle, right? That change is science fiction, that we have to envision a Minnesota where these things are solvable, where we can imagine a place where there is equitable distribution of wealth, that folks are like, I think about my mom who worked, you know, we used to joke she had one job for each kid, right? Three jobs just to get ahead and buy a house. And we need to reimagine our economy as a place where we can actually, folks can work a job and take care of their families. So that's my presentation. I'll sit for questions, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate the conversation.
Well, thank you. And just so you know, I didn't know about the meeting that they had in Brooklyn Park. It would have been nice to know about that, but I do understand that we do have a large population out there, and we have a lot of dedicated people out there working hard, leaders in your community that are helping in the city and helping throughout. So, I got questions here. Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Terrell, I'm really impressed with one of your numbers here, and I'm wondering if it's outreach or what happened here, but you have an 88 percentile, according to your chart, of insured individuals. Is that correct?
You said 88% for... Are you looking at the annual report, Mr. Chair?
Right.
Yeah. On page 6, under health insurance coverage, yeah, this is a number that came from the state demographer. Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Terrell, did you do an outreach program, or what? It seems like a real high rate of insured for a population. Is that, congratulations. I mean,
Mr. Terrell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I apologize. I can't see your.
That's okay. Don't worry.
So this is a number that came from the state demographer. So we're literally just reporting on what the demographer what the demographer is reporting on. We didn't do an outreach program. Once again, we don't have a researcher in that regard. So this is, we worked with the demographer to find the stats in this report. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hewitt. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Terrell, for being here. I see you had some really interesting charts up there, but they're not in the book. Can I get those? First of all, can I get those charts?
Mr. Terrell. Mr. Chair, Representative Green, absolutely.
And then also, Mr. Chair and Mr. Terrell, would you be willing to make an appointment and come see me in my office? There's some things I'd like to discuss with you, because your charts are, at least this one and the other ones you had up there, they pretty much mirror the American Indian charts. And I'd like to talk to you about that, if I could.
Mr. Terrell.
So.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, absolutely. I'll be following up with the members of this community. Thank you.
And Mr. Terrell, if you could send those slides to all, to all of us, so we could see them and look at them, it would be helpful. We actually have them, so we can get them out to everybody in the committee. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little bit of more background about how you do your outreach.
Mm-hmm.
Is it like going into a community and going to a church or a business, or how do people know about it? And I guess secondly, how would the representatives know when you're working in our district?
Mr. Terrell.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Mason. So we work really hard to find partners. So primarily our outreach strategy in Greater Minnesota, we've been working a lot with the NAACP in different areas, and we've reached out to some legislators. Most of the time we'll give legislators a heads up when we're in their district. Representative Nelson, I apologize if you didn't get the invitation. You were definitely on my list that I checked off, and so I'll check the miscommunication on that. And so we typically let folks know when we're in their district, and we do our best to just meet with folks in the community and figure out what's going on, where are people at. We do a lot of phone calls. We have a statewide call that we do every month, where we're talking to folks in the community to try to build like real relationships, so that when we do want to host a meeting, we can fill our day with one-on-ones and get folks in the room together.
Representative Mason.
Thank you.
And I would say I might have missed it too, so that's it. Could be either way. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to one of the members' earlier questions, the state for many years has been a leader for health coverage, and I think, the most recent numbers I heard, the state as an average was over 90% have insurance. But the question, I'm curious, you had the initiative on social justice or criminal justice. What components of the president's criminal justice reform do you think would be good to do on the state level?
Mr. Terrell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I appreciate the question. You always ask good questions. I will say that the Second Chance Act, is that what you're referring to? Or the First Step Act, I apologize.
Mr. Chair, and it's both what passed, and I think there was a ceremony recently with some legislation passing, mm-hmm. but the whole initiative, I don't think all components have made it through.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Director Terrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam. So I actually, previous to my time at the council, I actually spent some time in D.C. working on that bill with Senator Cory Booker. I believe Representative Long could speak to this a little bit as well. And it, but the bill was that finally passed. You know, there's some really good things about it. But primarily speaking to the prison population, most of the changes, you know, the federal population in Minnesota is really low, right? And the federal population, federal prison population around the country is really low. And so I think there's a couple of provisions there that I think are really important. I would also say that my focus primarily has been on as far as like what we can do with our Department of Corrections and the Public Safety Department at the state level, because I think that's where we have the biggest impact. Without the bill in front of me, it's hard for me to, I don't want to misspeak about specific provisions. And I'm just having a hard time calling them to memory right now.
Representative Quam. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Terrell, we passed a bill unanimously out of the House yesterday, Representative Dabney's bill on racially restrictive covenants, which is an issue I've heard a lot about in my district. I've spoken to constituents who found these on their property deeds and were shocked. So I'm glad that we moved that forward, but I think it speaks to the bigger issue. You had data up on income disparities, but there's a larger history of wealth gap in terms of folks being excluded from home ownership, folks not being able to accumulate wealth over generations, and wondering if you have availability to that data and what trends you're seeing in the wealth gap.
Director Terrell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Long, it's a great question. So actually, I was watching the hearing last week with the folks from the prejudice mapping, and I reached out to them and sat down with them and learned a little bit more about their project. And I think what's great about that project and about the legislation that you all passed out of committee is that today African Americans have less than 1% home ownership. People have heard me say this before, that's actually a crisis, right? Like, how do you build wealth in America without land, without being able to build equity in your home and whatnot? Like, it is something that was, and it's not, once again, it's not an accident that we have less than 1% home ownership. And the thing I really appreciate about the project, that the prejudice mapping project, is that it reveals the historical infrastructure that was built intentionally to make sure that happened. And so I think that we need to have that conversation. I think there's a question about, you know, what can we do to reverse that trend and to address the years of policy that it created where we're at. And I'm excited for that conversation as well.
Representative Long. Any further questions? Well, thank you for being here, and hopefully we can work together and continue making progress.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And the next board that's up here would be the Council on Latino Affairs. And if you want, you can pull another chair from the inside there if you need more than three.
I think we'll be fine.
And welcome to committee Representative Kosnick. I understand you're going to introduce the presentation and then let them proceed with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Representative John Kosnick from Lakeville. For the last 4 years, it's been my pleasure to be appointed to the as one of the legislative liaisons or board members to the Latino Affairs Council, and I'm here just to lend my support for the work that they've done over the since I started. Actually, there was a transition led by this committee to restructure the councils, and I think it's been a good transition. The Executive Director Henry Jimenez and the staff here have really stepped up the professionalism and the work that the council has done to advise and inform the legislature on a variety of the different issues that have come before us. And I just am here to encourage you to, if you have any questions specific to any of the bills that you're working on, the staff here in the council has a wealth of data that can help you research your bills. And again, I just am here to again lend my support and encourage you to take a look and use them as a resource for the legislature as they were intended.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Jimenez, if you can identify yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony, and you can go from there.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Henry Jimenez. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. And for the record, I did not ask Mr. Kosnick to say those words. It came from him, but I appreciate it.
Mr. Jimenez, I saw him earlier, and I figured he'd want to come down here, but that's okay. He's always welcome in our committee.
Thank you. I also have two of my team members here. I'd like for them to introduce themselves for the record. I also do want to recognize Ripley Piedra Santa, who is one of our fellows, if she could just raise her hand.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias.
Yo soy Violeta Hernandez Espinosa, and I'm education liaison for the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. I think that's enough Spanish for the day at this hour of the day. And I've served in this capacity for a little over 2 years, and it's been exciting.
And your name
to
is?
To serve. Again, Violeta Hernandez Espinosa. Yes.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Buenos dias. Hola. If you want to hear more Spanish, I can follow up with that as well. My name is Rosa Toc, and I'm the Health Legislative and Policy Liaison for the Council, and I've also been in this capacity for 2 years and 4 months.
So as I start with my presentation, I should tell, since my colleagues are still in the room, that we're one of three of the fastest growing communities in the state of Minnesota. This is actually a special year for us. It's our 40-year anniversary of the council. 40 years ago, our community asked the legislature and the governor at the time to create a council, and here we are 40 years later. Unfortunately, there's still some issues that we need to address, but I hope that our information that we provide to you helps you make the right decision as you vote on bills that are important to your district and our communities. We have four staff. Actually, Eric Armankanki no longer is with us. He went on to a different job at the end of the year, but I want to make sure he gets credit for the work that we did in 2018. As you know, Rosa Toc does health, focuses on health. Violeta focuses on education. I focus on everything to do with the council and immigration. And Eric was focusing on economic development. I put their pictures up because I want you to make sure that you see that. We do statewide work. It's four of us. We do community engagement across the state. It's four of us. We try to connect with as many, if not all of you, at least once every session, and in the interim, if we've come out to some of your districts as much as we can. Remember, it's just four of us. And then our community also would like to see us in their communities, right? And so we're constantly asked to present on the information that we have to our communities across the state as well. Again, it's just four of us. On your packet, you'll have a fact sheet. I think you can see these. These are specific to your district. So there are specific numbers on your district, but also specific numbers of how the Latinos in your district and how they fare in the labor force, participation rate, unemployment rate, medium household income, population without health insurance, which I I know we had, I'm sorry, Representative mentioned about some numbers. Well, you can compare those to your district overall and that of the state. So hopefully those are helpful to you as well. And then high school education or higher. Obviously, we have more things to present on, but I think these are important numbers as you decide on how to impact not just the Latino community, but your district overall and the decisions that you make this session. The page after that is a one-pager info sheet on our council that looks like this. And we'll go over some of this as we go on, but the legislative priorities for our council, which are focused on those four areas, again, in education, economic development, health, and immigration. I know that there's more to the world than just those four areas, but again, remember, there's only four of us, so let's be really good at one thing each. And so for our council, you get those four, and if we can help you with anything else, we will look into it. We never say no. That's our issue. But in those four areas, I hope that you think that we are a reliable source of information for you. After that, you'll see a health one-pager. Rosa will talk about this a little bit further on the work that she's doing. And then right behind that, there's an equity impact note. That's right, folks, equity impact note. We do think that this is a way for us to be able to provide you information, not necessarily give you a position of where we're at, but be able to say, hey, look, based on this bill, this is how it's going to impact the Latino community and really other communities, because it's not just focused on the Latino community, but Rosa will speak more on that a little further. After that, you'll find a 1-3 pager on our education work, and Violeta will speak on that. And then at the end, we're still on the left side, folks, so it's been a busy year. On the left side, it's the biennial, like, one sheet of what we did last year. I don't know how we were able to manage it to put it in one sheet, but we know that's what you like, one pager, so. And then you'll see a report here. This is our 2017 Community Engagement Report, and I'm happy to tell you that our 2018 report is coming out hopefully in the next couple weeks here. So, but to give you an example of the intense engagement work that we've been doing, after that you can find the, it's like our executive summary of our results. And behind that, you'll find our 2018 legislative report, which is our mandate to report to you. I want you to look through this, but if you want to know the results of all this, it's this one pager. So we'll, I'll just go through my slides, and then I'll bring it back to my team, and then we'll close. This is just another example. Now we don't just do it for the House. As you can see, we do it for the Senate. It's a we're taking this as serious as possible, advise and inform the legislature. That's our job. We are to advise and inform you. The governor's office and Minnesotanos, that's not a misspelling. Minnesotanos is a Spanish word for Minnesotans. That is the way I would like to talk to you as. We are Minnesotans, and I hope that you can see the impact that our community is having and the overall benefit of the state. As you can see, just we went through the fact sheet already, so I'll skip that. Other ways of advising and informing, when we visited these communities across the state, we also created community profiles of the locations that we visited. For example, in Marshall, we just wanted to let people know a little bit more about Marshall here. We wanted folks to know about Wilmer, Worthington, and Moorhead and Rochester and the places that we've gone to, but we also heard some concerns, and so there was, we just picked the top three concerns that community had and put that in that community profile. When bills become law, we don't just disregard what happens after that. I think it's important to follow what happens and what was the intention of this body, what was the intention of that bill. And so we also made sure that, for example, there was some provisions on the Increased Teacher of Color Act, and Violeta can speak a little bit more. You know, there was a Minnesota teacher shortage student loan repayment program that came out of that. Did people know about that after the bill became law? and it was, we know, you know, there's so many things that happen so quickly, and some of those scholarships or some of those initiatives go in effect within a month and a half of you going back home. So we're still here and want to make sure that folks know what you did. That's a great program that benefits our community, and so we created these, I would say, marketing or flyers, whatever you want to call this, to make sure that our communities know of the work that you've done. This is great work, so let's highlight the work that you've done, and this is money going back to our community. So let's highlight what we've done to benefit our communities, right? So that's an example. We also create charts, we create maps that better help you tell what's best for your communities, right, for your districts. And so here's just a couple charts and graphs that we've created to be able to inform you and for you to be able to inform your constituents in your district. In 2017, we visited 7 communities. We visited a lot more than that, but intentionally in intense, like, listening sessions, I feel comfortable saying we did 7 of those, 7 communities, and we visited them more than once. We actually went to these communities 3 to 4 times because we knew that we can't just go and have a 2-hour listening session and think that we've heard everything. And we might have taken notes that maybe those members didn't feel that were accurate. So we went back, and I know we're not perfect, so we went back to those communities and say, is this what we heard you in a more professional setting, and say, hey, this is what we got from you. And sometimes most communities would say, yeah, that's great, and others, they would say, no, like, actually, this is what our intention was. And so that's why we went back to those communities 2 to 3 times. And last year we went to 9 of the communities. As you can see, that's the names of the communities that we visited. We contracted with local community members to help us become our community ambassadors. Like, as much as I would like to tell you, like, that's great, right? That's 40 people, and I believe that's in Worthington. For me to say that I could just show up and say, I'm with the state, and folks just show up, that's not the reality, right? We need to connect with the local folks, and they're the ones that were able to help us say, hey, you should come and talk to the state. The state wants to hear from you. What can they help us with so that they can bring it forward to their own legislators? And in some of these communities, we were happy to say that we were able to connect the local legislator, state rep or state senator, and even other municipal leaders to these communities, and then be able to present something like this to them. I'm not telling them what they need to do. The community's saying this is what they need, and it's a way to help you make those decisions as you move in this session. Again, we went back, and I could tell you that everyone was really happy to see us come back and see their voices in this report, to see their faces in this report. They really appreciated that. These are just other graphics that we use to be able to inform our community and legislators on what we heard from this report. That from this report came our legislative priorities, and so again we're focused on those 4 areas: education, economic development, health, immigration. Unfortunately, right now, again, we're down 1 person, so our economic development person is not here. So that's the burden of having a small team. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that if someone leaves, when you have a team of 4, you go down to, you're down 25% of your staff, right? And so I hope that if you are in need of some economic development support, I hope that you give me an extra day to get that information to you. But we still are committed to that because that's what our community told us. And my team will talk a little bit more of their areas. You know, since our restructuring over 3 years ago, we have expectations of ourselves, and there's standards of ourselves moving forward, not just of ourselves, not just from you, but our community. We have become a trusted, reliable source of information. We're legislative and policy leaders within our community, and I would say even within here. We conduct research, we collect data, and produce reports, and present findings and provide updates periodically to our community, to you. Legislative priorities are available before the start of session. I'm not making things up as session goes. I'm presenting to you what our legislative priorities are, and they might not be politically feasible, but as a nonpartisan, as a state agent, I don't believe that my job is to do what's politically feasible. It's what present to you what our community has asked you of. Visit communities across the state. We're committed to that. In greater Minnesota, we're committed to that. We have a Minnesotanos Day at the Capitol, legislative recap. People need to know what we did this every session. And we have leadership meetings throughout the year. And those are what is expected of us, and we will continue to do that. Just an example, this is in November, our annual legislative leadership meeting where we present our legislative priorities based from what we heard from them. The first year we started doing this, we expected 15 people, and I would have been happy with five, to be honest with you, and about 60 people showed up. The next year, we were expecting, 60 people to show up, and 100 people showed up, and last year over 100 people. It's to the point where I am excited to see that people are interested in this process. People are interested in giving a voice, and I think they feel comfortable with us because it's not one-sided. We're not just providing views from the left or the right. We're providing the views of the community and presenting them to you in a way where it's useful to you. So that's it for my slides. I want to give some time to my team here. I would like for Violeta to talk a little bit about her work in education. So, thanks. Oh, yes.
Again, identify yourself for the tape and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, Violeta Hernandez Espinosa, and I'm Education Liaison for the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. And again, I've served in this capacity over the last 2 years. And there's three key statistics I would like to share with you about Latinos in Minnesota. And one of those key statistics, you'll find out, I have a nice handout for you, an overview of our community and how young our community is. Two key facts, about 40% of the 285,000 Latinos in the state of Minnesota are children, so under the age of 18. And we have a median age in our community of 24. So when we think of the Latino community, you could almost say that those of us sitting here are elders in the community, right? And this makes it imperative to address the educational needs of not only these Latino communities, but it's imperative for the state as our community continues to grow and has significant impact here at the state. Two other things that I would like to share with you is K-12 enrollment is about 82,000 Latino students and about 14,000 students in our undergraduate higher education. So we have, when you look at that, that's about 100,000 of the 285,000 Latinos in the state of Minnesota. So I take my role very seriously, and we've focused on a couple areas. You'll notice it's pretty small on the screen. You can't see, but you have a handout. One of our main priorities has been ensuring that data disaggregation continues. The departments have done this on and off depending on particular projects, but we want to ensure that it's provided in a standard way so we can continue to have that data. And it's important, it's been a priority for our council for over 4 years, and that's a continuation of our work. And just to give you an example, you asked questions about the importance of disaggregation. Only 19.8% of Latinos in Minnesota, in comparison to 50% for all races here in the state, is 19.8%, right, for Latino communities. So 19.8% have an associate's degree or higher between the ages of 25 and 44, in comparison to 50% for the whole state. When you disaggregate that, again, the Latino community as we refer to, is not a homogeneous Latino community. We represent over 20 different geographic origins, right? Over 20 countries of Latin America. And just to give you an example, in that particular statistic, again, Puerto Rican heritage Latinos have an attainment rate, an associate's degree or higher, at 53%, a little bit higher than the state average, right, for that statistic. However, when you contrast that, Mexican heritage Latinos have a 15% attainment of an associate's degree or higher. So, and then other Latino subgroups, it's 28%, right? So that allows us to ask the question of why, right? We don't have all the answers, but if we don't even have the data, we can't even ask that question. So that's been one of the big projects, is ensuring that we continue to do that. The other main project and the biggest project for our council and as a joint project among the three state ethnic councils and the Indian Affairs Council is addressing our state's severe shortage of teachers of color and American Indian teachers. Even with the new supply and demand report, which just came out last week, we still have 4.3% teachers of color in the state of Minnesota in comparison to 33.5% students of color and American Indian. This is not only having a huge impact on that particular profession and professionals of color, but also having an impact on our nation-leading achievement gaps. We still have, ladies and gentlemen, nation-leading achievement gaps for communities of color and American Indian communities. And again, when you're talking about 33.5% of the population, it becomes imperative that Minnesota addresses this. And so, again, we have the Increased Teachers of Color Act of 2019 that will be introduced later this week into early next week, hoping latest Monday. When you have a highly high stakeholder engagement-driven bill, it takes a little bit longer to put the finishing touches, and we believe that there's no other legislative proposal in education addressing equity that has been vetted by more stakeholders than probably this comprehensive effort. Again, our council has been leading on that effort, but it's been an effort of the three state ethnic councils and Indian Affairs Council over the last 2 years and into this new biennium until we significantly move the needle on that particular issue. So with that, I think that that's all I wanted to share with you. We hope to have your support on that particular bill.
Thank you, Ms. Hernandez. Again, identify yourself for the tape and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the council, this committee. Again, my name is Rosa Tok, and in the last 2 years and a half, I've been serving in this capacity as the person who is focused on health issues, on healthcare issues, health equity issues. I think that it's important to mention that when we talk about health, we need to also think about how the other areas are interconnected with education, with economic development, with migration. So the perspective that we are trying to bring to this area is that since all these areas are interconnected, we need to think with a model of both the social determinants of health, what are the factors that are affecting or challenging our diverse Latino communities, and also having a health in all policies perspective, so that when we inform or when we advise to you members or other policymakers or other state agencies, how important it is to take into consideration that the kinds of legislation or the kinds of policies that we are going to enact will also have a positive impact in the health of all communities in the state and also of our diverse communities. And this is the perspective and the lens that we are trying to bring to the work that we do at the Council. And I'm not going to go over this brief that you all have in your packet. I think that that's something that you might want to do later, because it's a little bit long. But this brief as well as the legislative priorities for our council, as my colleague Violeta and as our executive director mentioned, are based on what we've been hearing from our communities in these different towns, 17 community listening sessions in 15 towns. They have informed us, and they have corroborated what research and what studies show around issues that affect Latinos in general and the disparities that we're still facing as a state. So there are three main issues that that community has wanted us to address in this biennium. And one of them has to do with, I think that my colleague Sia, Katie, mentioned, one of them is to review the current MDH roster on medical interpretation and update it to a registry system. And that is based on community input regarding the necessity, the need of having a pool of interpreters that have minimum standards in medical interpretation and be reassured that when they go to a clinic, when they go to a hospital, when they have interactions with medical providers, them and their families are relying in quality interpretation. And you can imagine that that's sometimes a matter of life and death. And so I'm very appreciate that we are doing that work in coordination and collaboration with my colleagues at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, because this is an issue that affects not only our communities, but approximately 200,000 Minnesotans have limited English proficiency, and this is very important for our communities. I'm happy to know now that we have a group of very influencing legislators in the Senate that are offering that bill, including Senator Wicklund. We also have, we want to do that as a bipartisan effort, and so we also have on board Senator Limer and Senator Benson, who are also supporting this bill. The number one issue for our communities is increase to healthcare insurance. We are the group with the largest gap in terms of accessing health insurance in the state of Minnesota, and that's something that our communities are also telling us, to tell members of the legislature and others, that this is the number one issue for them. As we know, when we have access to health insurance, we can also access the hospitals, the clinics, and have preventive care. And I think that that's something that is very important, not only for our communities, but the state as a whole, if we want to make sure that the next workforce labor in the state is healthy and well-educated, well-trained. I think that that's something that we need to take into consideration if we want to be a competitive, economically competitive state, and not only in the nation, but around the world. So that's very important. Also, the importance of preventive healthy living initiatives. Our communities also face high rates of diabetes, of obesity, chronic diseases, and all of these are preventable conditions that can be also part of ensuring that there are funds for programs, health public programs, that can address all of these conditions before they accelerate, or that they get into a point where many of these people have to go to hospital and get very serious interventions that sometimes they cannot afford because they don't have health insurance. So as you see, it's like a is this circle, it's a vicious circle that we need to see in a comprehensive way so that we can reduce those disparities in our communities. And also the need for community health clinics and multicultural centers where people understand how to better navigate the medical system, pretty much like in the in education, how important it is to know how it is important not only to have health literacy as part of understanding how to navigate the system, but also the right support culturally sensitive for many of these communities. So this is pretty much a scope of the legislative priorities in health. I have to also say and recommend to you that there was a study published last year by the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota around the cost of health inequities in the state of Minnesota, and one of the recommendations and one of the things that they say is that by addressing these health inequities, it would save the state of Minnesota $2.6 billion a year, approximately 776 lives a year. So these are important numbers, because if we are saving that cost on health inequities, we are able to then shift those costs and those investments to public transportation, hospitals, schools, or other programs that are health preventive. And so on that note of health equity and equity, I'd like to Okay, and sorry if I'm taking the time, Mr. Chair.
We have people with questions.
The health equity impact note, which is the first year that we are trying to respond to some questions as to how bills or policy can impact our community, and whether or not we have done our due diligence of consulting with communities that might be impacted by these policies, and also other considerations so that policies don't adversely impact our communities. Thank you very much.
And Mr. Jimenez, do you know if the spoken language bill that's in the Senate, do we have a House author for that? I meant to ask Ms. Herr that, but you mentioned it also, so do you know if we have a House author yet?
Yeah, I'll let Rosa speak on that, too.
Mr. Chair, members, we are still looking for a House author.
Thank you. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about education, and to any of the testifiers, and I can relate from my educational experience. I didn't like being in school. It wasn't me. So I can see where it's really more difficult nowadays, because things like social media and so forth, I didn't like it then. I'd hate it a whole lot more now. And what I'm wondering is what efforts you might have going, especially in the elementary grades, to get students comfortable with being there, because when we face things, just the normal peer pressure and the social media today, and then you add language barriers and possibly income barriers and so forth, to engage them at a younger age to actually enjoy going to school, if you have anything going on with that.
Proceed, yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative, one of the key aspects of the Increased Teachers of Color Act, and again, this particular bill, even though we have a particular focus on addressing this particular shortage, is very comprehensive, and it's addressing actually school environment and school climate. In particular, during our listening sessions, we heard many of Latino communities or children feel like they don't belong because they don't see themselves reflected in the curriculum or what's taught in the classroom. They don't see themselves reflected in their teachers. Again, we only have 629 Latino teachers in the state of Minnesota. While we're saying that, we're not saying that other teachers cannot educate Latino students, but it's a very different experience when an educator has a lens and an experience that you may be able to share, right? Again, as an immigrant myself, coming to southern Minnesota at the age of 10, that was a major shock, not knowing the language, not hated mashed potatoes, hated pizza, did not know what burgers were. Those are my favorite foods now, but it takes a long time, right? And I had just shared recently with colleagues that I got in trouble once for going to the bathroom because I didn't know how to ask to go to the bathroom, and then I couldn't explain why I had to go without asking, but couldn't explain because I didn't speak the language. And that experience is not isolated. We, in our listening sessions throughout the last 2 years, we've heard that very loudly, particularly with, especially for Latino communities, with the national climate and the national rhetoric around immigrant communities and particularly Mexican communities. As you know, the majority of Latinos in Minnesota are of Mexican heritage. That has become also very hard for Latino students. So with that particular, again, we have a couple provisions in the Increased Teachers of Color Act that address school environment and address how not only how teachers are retained, but how students can feel more comfortable in the classrooms, in their supports, making sure that cultural liaisons are supported as well.
And if we can keep our answers a little shorter so we're not filibustering our way out of here. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was answered along the way.
Well, thank you. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have had the opportunity to talk with the staff from this council, and I do appreciate it. I'm going to there's one of the buildings, apartment buildings in my district, has a high Latino or Hispanic population. And I remember a couple of years ago, one of the gentlemen was saying that he was taking English as a second language. But he was amazed at how few people of Hispanic background were taking that. So he started asking people. And the main thing he heard is they have, you know, they have so many jobs that they just don't have time to learn the language. And I see that as a major problem, and then I'm also wondering how that affects their children along the way as well.
Ms. Hernandez, make it quick. We have to get out of here by 9:30.
Yes.
We
Thank
have
you,
rules
Mr. Chair.
Coming in.
That continues to be one of the highest needs for the Latino community. And as we heard, it's not only a matter of the requirement from work, but also because we don't have intensive English language programs. We still are focused on community community education programs that are only 1 or 2 hours. So it's hard to engage and really learn a language through that as some intensive programs. Intensive programs is what our community has asked for, and unfortunately, that is not available unless you're going through very traditional educational institutions.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you. I'll make this a comment so that we can discuss it later, maybe offline. But having given birth in Europe, where I didn't know what languages would be spoken by the specialist who would come in the room to help me assist in that delivery, I understand the need to have medically competent translators in the room. And also in Brazil, having lived there and having to take a children's book with pictures to make sure that the doctor and I could communicate about health issues for my children, I understand the need for medically competent translators to be in the room. As we think about medical care across our state, closing facilities and making sure that we have a registry, that's really important. And to making sure that our dollars are spent well on the care, but also that there is a comfort and trust between medical providers. So I would appreciate to have that conversation with you offline, and I'll just leave it as a statement.
Okay. And with that, members, we're going to have to adjourn. So thank you for your presentation, and we're adjourned.